morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and elsewhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today and every Thursday morning from 11 to noon from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. I'm Patrick Mott. Well, it's been more than half a century since Clive Staples Lewis died at his home near Oxford, England, but his books continue to sell at a rate and volume that still makes religious book publishers shake their heads, so much so that John Blake, the belief blogger for CNN, said that the former medieval literature professor has become the Elvis Presley of Christian publishing. Blake was, of course, talking about the much-loved C.S. Lewis, the author of many landmark Christian books for adults, who is perhaps best known for his children's fantasy, The Chronicles of Narnia. With us today on the phone is Dr. Paul Ford. He is a professor of theology and liturgy at St. John's Seminary in Camarillo, who is also an internationally recognized expert on the life and writings of C.S. Lewis. He has written a handful of books about Lewis himself and is a board member of the C.S. Lewis Foundation, which is headquartered in Redlands. Dr. Ford, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Pat.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. Now, C.S. Lewis was not Catholic, but Catholics are sometimes surprised when they find that out. Why do you think he's found such an audience among Catholic readers?
Well, he found his audience in this country right after the Second World War with his book, The Screwtape Letters.
Right.
And Mere Christianity and a few other things. He became well known to people in Britain because of his broadcast talks over the BBC during the war. And, you know, I suppose if he were an Anglican today, he would probably be a pastoral provision Anglican or maybe even Roman Catholic. But he was raised in Northern Ireland, and his grandfather, his mother's father, was a famous Anglican preacher, Church of Ireland preacher, and he was definitely anti-Catholic, but so were most Protestants at the time in Northern Ireland especially. So he picked up those prejudices and kind of kept them throughout his life, although he had dear, close Catholic friends and worshipped in an Anglo-Catholic church in Oxford and outside of Oxford, went to monthly confession after he returned to his faith. So it doesn't surprise me because that he's, you know, really appreciated by Catholics and really all Christians, most Christians. There are some Christians that have no use for him because they worry that his Narnia Chronicles are about New Age and witchcraft and all that kind of stuff. But for most Christians, he's one of those guys that you can share with any other Christian and get an awful lot out of.
You mentioned him returning to his faith. He actually lost his faith at one point, right?
He did. As a precocious 9-year-old, in one summer, one year, his uncle, his grandfather, so it was maybe it was a great uncle, a grandfather, and his mother, all died of cancer in their home in outside of Belfast. And being a religious home, people told him that if he prayed hard enough, God would save his mother, heal his mother, and God didn't seem to answer that prayer, and Lewis stopped believing in a benevolent God. In fact, his picture of God was rather fierce at the time, that God was a cosmic sadist. So he went through a hypocritical confirmation ceremony as an Anglican, as a Church of Ireland boy. When he was 13, that meant he received his first communion and was confirmed, but never practiced his faith for another 23 years. So he was teaching, having survived the war, First World War and all that, teaching at Oxford.
Yeah, that takes us up to that. He becomes an Oxford Don. He's tutoring in English and literature at Magdalen College, Oxford, and he still hasn't embraced Christianity. But there he falls in with a pretty interesting crowd at a pretty interesting place. Tell us about the inklings and the influence they had on him.
Yeah, well, he began when he loved reading. And one of the people whose books he loved to read, starting at 16, was George MacDonald, a great Scottish preacher and pastor and novelist. And one of his books called Fantasties converted his imagination, C.S. Lewis says in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And then he read Chesterton in 1925, so he would have been 27 at the time, The Everlasting Man, and he said that book converted his intellect, but it was his twice-a-week Beer and Beowulf gatherings at the Eagle and the Child and in another professor's rooms. The Eagle and the Child, nicknamed the Bird and the Baby.
Right.
It's a pub on the Broad in Oxford, and very famous people began to collect around Lewis and another fellow, J.R.R. Tolkien. And they were together from the early 30s straight through Lewis's transfer from Oxford to Cambridge, so that would be 56. So they had 20 years of mutual support and reading to each other, sharing ideas. And it was actually Tolkien who was the closest agent of Lewis's, hard to find a word for it. You want to say conversion, but in some ways it was reconversion. And we can be indebted to C.S. Lewis that Tolkien ever finished The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and we can be indebted to Tolkien that C.S. Lewis became a Christian again.
Well, let's talk for a second about Lewis's accessibility. He is he's hanging out with this group of people, the Inklings, who do have considerable influence on him. And so many of the people of the time were used to hearing about religion discussed in a pretty high-minded manner. But Lewis brought the discussion a lot closer to earth, I believe, particularly with, you mentioned it earlier, the Screwtape Letters.
Yeah. The Screwtape Letters was quite accidental. Lewis was a Christian now, and in the late 30s, he was at church one day, and he got this brilliant idea. What if I talked about the experience of temptation from the devil's point of view? How would the devil go about tempting a newly minted Christian? And even it's somewhat autobiographical. C.S. Lewis often chided people for thinking that he had done an awful lot of study of theology. Actually, he had, but that he had read a lot of books on moral counseling and everything. He said, no, I'm a sinner, and I just tried to understand how the devil tempts me and try to help people understand how the devil tempts anybody. And it was that whimsy and very concrete writing. He has a gift for story and metaphor and simile that few writers at the time had. People's preaching, the preaching at the time, and actually it's a continual failure of preaching, is that they contemplate the truth, but they don't, the preachers contemplate the truth, but they don't seem to enjoy it. And C.S. Lewis enjoyed his Christian faith, practiced it, and was able to talk to other people about it.
And it comes through very clearly in the Screwtape Letters. It's such a lot of fun to read.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about his marriage. He got married rather late in life, and it was quite a unique marriage, and it influenced him deeply. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, he was a bachelor by choice because he had made a promise to a wartime buddy that if either of them died in the war, the other would take care of the parent left behind. And Patty Moore was his buddy, and Patty died in the First World War, and so Jack Lewis, who had met Mrs. Moore and her daughter before the war, he took them, they set up house together. They pooled their resources and were able to buy a house eventually outside Oxford and live there somewhat happily. Lewis's books, you know, began to sell overseas, and in America, they fell into the hands of a man named Bill Gresham and his wife, Joy Davidson Gresham. And they were both atheists and poets. She was a Jewish atheist, and he was a former Protestant. And the book, especially Mere Christianity, converted them. He was a miserable alcoholic, unfortunately, and actually, you know, beat his wife and children and stuff. So she moved out and actually went to England, first by herself, and then she brought her two sons. And some people would say set her cap for Jack Lewis, and he was free now. Mrs. Moore had died in 51, and he began to visit with Mrs. Gresham. And they were divorced, but he couldn't marry her because of the strict laws against divorce in his own Anglican faith. But he did agree to marry her in a civil ceremony in order to keep her from being expelled from the country as a former communist.
Let us pick that up just after we take a quick break. We're speaking with Dr. Paul Ford, one of the foremost authorities on the life and writings of C.S. Lewis. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of Lewis's best-known books, including The Chronicles of Narnia. Please stay with us.
Come out and enjoy America's pastime with your friends and loved ones. It's Catholic Night at Angel Stadium. Root on the Angels with Bishop Van and your congregation. Then end the evening with a family-friendly movie out on the field at Angel Stadium. The movie is included in the price of your ticket. For the best prices and special seating areas, go to angels.com/Catholic Night. Be sure to put in the promo code Catholic. Hurry, the best tickets will go quickly. Go to angels.com/Catholic Night and enter Catholic. See you there. The Orange Catholic Foundation provides you the opportunity to leave a personal legacy and support your passion with our Catholic faith. A legacy gift is a gift that comes from your financial or estate planning. Gifts could come from appreciated securities or stock, real estate, a retirement plan, or life insurance. Some donors are in a position to make a gift during their lifetime. Others make the gift as a bequest in their will. Plan gifts can offer many benefits to you, including tax benefits or the potential for returned income. The Orange Catholic Foundation offers many ways to support the Catholic causes you care about. No matter the amount of gift you make, they have a giving option available to best support your passion within our Catholic faith. Contact the Orange Catholic Foundation today to learn about the Light of Christ Legacy Society and how your planned gift can make a difference. Reach them on the web at orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org. They're here to help you serve your Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange.
With Dr. Paul Ford, and the topic is the great Christian writer C.S. Lewis, one of the most widely read and influential authors of our age. Just before we took a break, we were talking about Lewis's marriage to Joy Davidman Gresham. He has just married her in order to prevent her from being deported from England. Let's pick it up there. What happens after that?
What happens after that is that she contracts breast cancer, and in fact, she doesn't know she has it until it had metastasized and had gotten into her bones. So she is dying of breast cancer, and she begs Jack Lewis to make her an honest woman, as she said. And in a hospital ceremony conducted by an Anglican priest from another diocese, one of C.S. Lewis's students, Father Peter Bide, they have a bedside wedding, and laying on his hands, Bide was one of the first, you could call him, charismatic Anglican priests. And C.S. Lewis privately prayed that her pain be passed to him, and it seems that it was. He became subject to osteoporosis, and she had a recovery of 4 years. So quite symmetrically and quite providentially and quite amazingly, here he is, married to a woman dying of breast cancer, about to leave her two sons without a parent. And that's exactly what his mother died of, leaving her two sons emotionally orphaned at when he was 9 years of age. So it's a story told in that wonderful movie. It actually started off as a play and it became a movie, Shadowlands.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little more about that, just a little farther down the line. We're going to kind of end up with that, if you don't mind.
All right.
Now, you started reading Lewis when you were yourself just a kid. What of his did you read, and why did you fall in love with it?
You could say that my imagination was baptized by reading C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, which talks about a bus trip that 21 ghosts who live in hell get a chance to go to purgatory, the outskirts of heaven, for a day, and they can stay in heaven if they will just give up the one thing that they're clinging to that is keeping them in hell. And this just knocked me out. I mean, every adolescent has long seasons of hopelessness and lack of faith and hope and love. And this book gave me not only a reason to believe, but a picture of what heaven might be like. And it's still my favorite book these many years. I had heard of the Screwtape Letters actually through a homily given by a Jesuit in my high school. instructing us high school students how the devil tempts us, and I went up to the Jesuit and praised him for the work, and he said, oh my goodness, I stole it from an Anglican in a book called The Screwtape Letters, and I went to a bookstore, it was sold out, and so my first C.S. Lewis book is still my favorite, The Great Divorce.
Well, probably his most famous series of books, and probably the best-selling series of books, are the Narnia books, the Chronicles of Narnia. There are seven of them. And to date, they've sold more than 100 million copies. Now, that's a lot of kids and a lot of adults as well reading those. Is the Christian allegory in them beside the point to a lot of kids, or is it something that you understand as you get older?
Well, I think he wrote them as something as a subversive. He wanted to do what MacDonald had done for him, to baptize imagination. And so he set about writing just one book, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and two others came along rather quickly. And then the pivotal book in the middle is called The Horse and His Boy, and that I think that book taught him the power of the figure of Christ that he had created, Aslan. And so his last three books, The Silver Chair, The Magician's Nephew, and The Last Battle, are somewhat allegorical. And in fact, Tolkien didn't like them because they were too allegorical. But C.S. Lewis was a mythologizer in an age of demythologizers. He tried to help us. But as he said, you know, the reason our reasons are the organ of truth, but the imagination is the organ of meaning. And so he's trying to address the issue of the meaning of Christian truth without trying to do a strict allegory. He called them supposals. Supposing there was a world in which mythological beings and animals talked and were real, and this world had fallen, how would it have fallen and how would it have been saved? So it all starts out with a supposal, as he says.
That combination of truth and imagination that that you've mentioned before.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's talk just a second about one of his other works, Mere Christianity. Now, these are a series of essays, are they not, taken from some of his radio talks during the war in England that were so popular?
Actually, it would be better to call them transcripts.
Okay.
He wrote everything out, and he had to read it rather quickly on the radio because the Nazis were listening in on British radio, and if there was ever a pause, English-speaking Nazis would actually break into a BBC broadcast. So everything was written out, and it started out as one series of four talks, I think it was, Right and Wrong, about, as a clue to the meaning of the universe, and then a book called What Christians Believe, and then another series, excuse me, and then Christian Behavior, and finally, really, his book on prayer and mysticism. So after the war, these were so well received. He edited them together and added a few bridge chapters, and it became the book Mere Christianity. And it's the one that is, after the Narnia books and the Screwtape Letters, the one that is most often put into people's hands, together, you know, with another book called A Grief Observed.
Yes.
Which is often put into the hands of people who have just lost a loved one. This was a book of Lewis's own journaling, which he wrote anonymously after the death of Joy Davidman, in which he works through his feelings. You know, maybe all of this is illusion and God is, again, a cosmic sadist, and he's killed my wife and rendered her sons motherless and all that. But by the end, he returns much more strongly and much more beautifully to his faith. So A Grief Observed is also a book that a lot of people have heard about.
And that has probably brought a lot of comfort to a lot of people as a result, particularly if they know the story behind it all.
Exactly, yeah.
And I'd like to get into that story to wind up today in the last about 4 minutes that we have. Let's talk about Shadowlands. The BBC made a movie by that name, Shadowlands, back in the 1950s, where the wonderful actor Joss Ackland played Lewis and Claire Bloom played Joy. Later on, Richard Attenborough directed a very fine version of the same story. It was released as a film in 1993 that starred Anthony Hopkins as Lewis and Deborah Winger as Joy. And I can tell you that this is a three Kleenex box movie. What's your opinion of it, and do you think it was essentially true to its subject?
Well, I love both versions, but I'm partial to the first version because there are two sons in it. I can understand when you're writing a screenplay or it actually started out as a stage play.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to compress things and maybe drop characters and heighten things and conflicts and whatever. Nevertheless, for all of the stage and screen manipulations, the story comes across. And it's either version of the story has spoken to an awful lot of people, and they still come stumbling across it. And it can be very powerful.
It's a very affecting story on many levels because you've got a man here who, particularly in the Attenborough version, who has constructed a life for himself that is proscribed, that's comfortable. He has built walls. He has cut himself off almost unconsciously from a lot of emotion and a lot of deep feeling. And then this woman comes into his life and just completely upsets that apple cart.
Yes. And that's a good way to describe it. In his conversion story, his version of the Confessions of C.S. Lewis called The Surprised by Joy.
Yes.
He describes God as the great interferer. And Lewis felt that he wanted to wall off a place inside of himself where God could not cause him any pain. And so this woman comes along, and it's very interesting, you know. He's writing Surprised by Joy at the same time he's writing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and here is a winter frozen, and it goes through springtime because Lewis's feelings are thawed, and he becomes a human being, really, because of his marriage to Joy Davidson. So it's Lewis's life and his works are wonderfully illuminating of each other.
And they are still available just about everywhere. If you are interested in purchasing any of Lewis's books, all you need to do is walk into almost any bookstore, and they are there, correct?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They're all over the place, however. They're in the fiction section and in religion and in literary criticism and memoir and biography. So you have to probably just do a search online under C.S. Lewis, and you'll be surprised. There are at least, I would say there's almost 70 books.
My goodness.
That are derived from the original 54 that he left us with when he died.
Well, Dr. Paul Ford, many thanks for taking time to be with us today and to give us such a thorough picture of C.S. Lewis and much of his writing. It's been a pleasure. All of Lewis's books are, of course, still in publication, and for those of you who would like to delve further into his writings, we recommend Dr. Ford's book, Companion to Narnia, which is now, I think, in its fifth edition, am I right?
Yes.
And it's published by HarperCollins. Please stay with us. We will be right back after this.
Orange Catholic Foundation provides you the opportunity to leave a personal legacy and support your passion with our Catholic faith. A legacy gift is a gift that comes from your financial or estate planning. Gifts could come from appreciated securities or stock, real estate, a retirement plan, or life insurance. Some donors are in a position to make a gift during their lifetime. Others make the gift as a bequest in their will. Plan gifts can offer many benefits to you, including tax benefits or the potential for returned income. The Orange Catholic Foundation offers many ways to support the Catholic causes you care about. No matter the amount of gift you make, they have a giving option available to best support your passion within our Catholic faith. Contact the Orange Catholic Foundation today to learn about the Light of Christ Legacy Society and how your planned gift can make a difference. Reach them on the web at orangecatholicfoundation.org. That's orangecatholicfoundation.org. They're here to help you serve your Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange.
Welcome back to Orange County Catholic Radio. On the phone with us is Dr. Victoria Graff. She is a professor of special education in the Department of Educational Support Services at Loyola Marymount University. And she's going to tell us about a unique schools program designed for children with Down syndrome and autism that benefits both these categories of special learners and everyone else in the classroom. This program of inclusion was being tested out recently at the school at Mission Basilica San Juan Capistrano, and the early buzz is very hopeful and exciting. And it's being administered out of LMU's Catholic Inclusive Education Program, which prepares teachers and administrators in Catholic schools to become leaders in supporting parochial school students who have exceptional needs. Dr. Graf, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, give us an overview of the program. I imagine this is something that a lot of parents of children with special needs are pretty happy about.
Yes, I certainly hope so. I think the Diocese of Orange has been very progressive in this area. They really have been a leader among the various dioceses across the country in designing programs to support all students. And while we're talking today maybe a little more specifically about students with various learning challenges such as autism and Down syndrome, really the diocese is trying to create programs that support all learners, and that also includes students who are gifted and talented. So we're trying to be sure that all the teachers and administrators are prepared to really be able to accept and include all students, even including those with some varying abilities and specific learning challenges.
Well, this seems like an obvious filling of a need, but it hasn't been done, I don't think, at this level of commitment before, has it?
I would agree. I think that's true. I think the diocese should be commended for saying that while we've been working with one specific school, Mission Basilica, the vision and really the dream is that this program would expand to all schools, both at the elementary level as well as at the high school level, to be able to, again, help all students be successful. So I would say this is rather unique, you know, for a diocese to make this kind of commitment to their children, their Catholic children that are in the diocese. So, yes, this is a wonderful opportunity for the diocese to serve all of God's children.
Well, you're talking about taking this all the way up to the high school level. This I did not know. Is this something that's going to be happening in the relatively near future?
Hopefully, yes. We've been working at the elementary level. I'm at the stage now, though, that I want to start having conversations with the various high schools. I mean, there are high schools in the diocese that have already moved in this direction. Santa Margarita and Mater Dei specifically have had programs for a number of years. I'm just becoming familiar with their programs, so I want to see how we might be able to support the work that they're doing and hopefully expand it. I think one of the misunderstandings oftentimes by Catholic high schools is that while they say they are college prep and obviously very rigorous in terms of their academic offerings, universities such as Loyola Marymount, which is a Catholic private university, does accept students with varying disabilities. We actually have a significant proportion, I'd say about 10% of our student population, have disabilities, including students on the autism spectrum. So Catholic high schools shouldn't be worried that if they accept a student with a particular learning challenge, that it will be difficult for them to be accepted at the university level. I think that's something that we hope we can help educate parents and teachers and administrators at the high school level, that they should open their doors and be welcoming to all students.
Well, that's something I think that's also going to be very good news to a lot of parents. Is there a learning curve on the part of everyone involved, the students, the special kids, the parents, the teachers, the administrators? Is this something that has to be sort of worked into, or is it something that people adapt to pretty readily and easily?
That's a very good question. I think the children have less trouble with that. I think the children typically, especially in a Catholic school, using the gospel as the benchmark and really the foundation, the children, you know, really do embrace diversity, and, you know, they certainly would be, have friendships with students with varying needs. I do think that it is a bit of a learning curve, specifically for teachers and administrators. Ironically, prior to some federal legislation that was passed in the 1970s, Catholic schools in the various parishes did accept all children. That was what they saw as their mission. And then once there was money for public schools, then Catholic schools said, you know, actually, if you have a specific learning challenge, you'll be better served in a public school. So I think it is kind of a reset, if you will, for teachers and administrators to know that there is opportunity for them to learn skills and that it doesn't cost a lot of money. I think, you know, part of the myth is that this is a very expensive program in terms of, you know, technology and so forth. But that's really not the case. So I think parents will be very happy to know that schools are very willing now to learn new techniques to be able to accept students. We just did a needs assessment in the Diocese of Orange, and across the board, teachers and administrators are willing to accept students with varying abilities. They just need the help in terms of professional development to really know how to do this in the best possible way.
Well, in this particular environment, the classroom environment, the students, in a sense, also become teachers, don't they? They also become teachers to themselves and to their peers. There's more responsibility placed on them, and is there more expected of them?
Well, I mean, I don't know in the sense of it more being expected of them necessarily. I think, you know, children are pretty natural at, you know, forming friendships and, you know, having buddies and so forth. And, you know, they like to be little teachers, you know, and to be able to, if they know something well, they want to be able to share that information with their friends. So you're catching on to something I think that's very important, is this notion of peer tutoring or peer interaction.
Yes.
That can be very helpful, not only for the student who might be a little slower or have a more challenge, but it just enhances then the knowledge that the student has who is really helping out his friend or her friend.
What about the teachers? What sort of teaching skills are needed for this? What has to be cultivated on the part of the teachers in order for this program to work at its best?
That's a great question, another great question. And actually, now I can speak a little more specifically about Mission Basilica. There's an approach that's called Universal Design for Learning, UDL, that actually is based on principles of architecture. And if you, you know, walk down a street, a main street in any city, you'll see curb cuts that come, you know, at the end of the sidewalk. Well, those curb cuts really benefit everyone. So if you're on a skateboard, or if you're pushing a grocery cart, or a buggy or something like that, as well as possibly being in a wheelchair, it provides universal access. And so we really don't think about it too much in terms of who it might have been originally designed for. So now we transfer that concept, if you will, to designing lessons. And instead of a teacher having to go back and, you know, retrofit or tweak a lesson that was already designed, using the principles of universal design, right from the beginning, they can design a lesson that's going to benefit a student who's gifted and high achieving, as well as a student who might, say, for example, have dyslexia or ADHD or any other type of learning disability, so that that student can also be successful. So UDL is definitely something that we've been working on at Mission Basilica. We've had good success with that. We've actually been doing some research on that just to see how the teachers are, you know, incorporating this approach with their students and so forth. So this is the approach that we're using that I think we'd like to see throughout the diocese.
Well, that curb cut analogy is just about perfect. I think people will be able to take that one away from this almost more than any other in order to understand this program. Tell us a little bit how the program has worked at the Mission Basilica School. Are there a lot of initial successes there you can point to?
Well, we just finished our second year of professional development.
Oh, okay.
And we started out very slowly. We wanted to, instead of just coming in as university faculty and researchers, we really wanted to engage the faculty themselves. And we started with the mission statement of Mission Basilica. And there we had a wonderful opportunity to be able to design really an approach that we thought would fit with who they are as a faculty. So we looked at their mission statement, and they said they wanted to build a diverse and inclusive community. So once we had that notion in mind, then we came in with this universal design for learning. And we've been doing some interviews with the teachers. We did some interviews to begin with, and then after the fact with the professional development. And we found that the teachers have really been embracing this. And they really like the idea that they're meeting the needs of more students in their classes and so forth. And so they've been very receptive to it. The other thing that we've been doing, which has been very beneficial, because with professional development, that really takes time to help a teacher be able to incorporate a new strategy into their repertoire. So we've been able to have coaches come down and actually be able to model some lessons for the teachers so they can see it in action. And then we've asked the teachers then to demonstrate a lesson using UDL, and then the coaches are able to actually give them some feedback on that. So we've just finished going through the entire faculty at Mission Basilica, and we're still in the process of collecting some data in terms of the impact of this on the actual practice of the teachers. But generally speaking, we've seen great success with it.
Well, Dr. Victoria Graff, thank you so much indeed for taking time to be with us today and to get us up to speed on a program whose time has obviously come. Much good luck with it in the future, and we'll be watching to see how the program progresses here in our diocese.
Well, and if I could just add one, I just picked up today the Orange County Catholic when I was at St. John Vianney, and there's a quote that you have in here by Pope Francis, and it says, "We need to see each child as a gift to be welcomed, cherished, and protected." And I think that's truly what our vision is with this work that we're doing in the diocese. So thank you for your support in terms of all of this.
Our pleasure. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with our friend Monsignor Mike Hare, who's going to tell us what happens when several dozen priests get out of town and go on a retreat in the desert.
It's America's favorite pastime meets movie night. That's right, two great events for the price of one ticket on Catholic Night. Baseball and the movie on Saturday, June 27th. Good tickets are still available, and we have special seating and pricing for you by going to angels.com/Catholic Night. That's angels.com/Catholic Night. And enter the promo code Catholic. Catholic Night is sure to hit one out of the park.
We are back, and here in the studio with us is our friend Monsignor Mike Hare. Monsignor Mike is the former Vicar General of the Diocese of Orange and the current pastor of St. Anne Church in Seal Beach. He recently returned from the annual priest retreat, which affords all the priests in the diocese an opportunity to get away from their regular parish gigs for 5 days and recharge their physical and spiritual batteries. All most of us know about this retreat is what we hear in the announcement at the end of Mass in the late spring, saying that for the coming week our parish priests are going to be out of here, and for 5 days there's going to be communion services instead of daily Masses. So what goes on at a priest retreat? Monsignor Mike is here to spill the beans for us. Monsignor, thanks so much for coming down today.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, okay, you guys are taking part of your plan from Jesus' playbook, where he went on retreat. He went to the desert.
Yes.
And that's where the priests go too, with a few more bells and whistles. Tell us about that a bit.
We go to La Quinta Resort in La Quinta in the desert. It's a big place, and there's room for all of us. When we first started as a diocese, we had a difficult time because there were so many of us, we couldn't all fit into a retreat house. So we came upon the idea of going to a hotel, and La Quinta Resort is a snazzy place, but we get a good deal because it's the beginning of their low season.
Because it's so hot.
Yes. And this week it's supposed to be 116 degrees.
Hey, well, how hot was it when you were there?
Oh, I think it just got to be like 101 or 102.
Oh, just balmy.
Well, I was born in Nevada, so I'm used to the dry heat.
Well, priests often refer to themselves as members of a unique fraternity, one in which the members generally get along well and enjoy being with each other. Does that carry over to the retreat as well?
Absolutely. When we first began as a diocese, there was so much energy. We were so happy not to be part of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, even though we were all happy to become priests of the Archdiocese. But so from the very beginning, we got together, and Bishop Johnson insisted that we all go on a retreat together because he wanted to build that fraternity. And since then, we've done it every year.
Now, is this common or uncommon? Do a lot of dioceses have this sort of thing where all the priests go on retreat together?
Some do. Many do not, because there are a lot of one-man places where there wouldn't be any coverage at all if they were away. And so they go to a retreat house. Some dioceses, they get together to do it. Other times the diocese says, well, you choose a place and go on a retreat and make your retreat on your own.
And in this diocese, we have a sufficient number, I I guess I should say, of retired priests, of order priests, things like that, that are willing to fill in.
We have that, and we also have the permanent deacons who can do communion services and help out.
Sure.
But some of the retired priests, they so much enjoy the retreat, and they're very welcome to. They join us.
We're going to get to that in just a second. Do you have a lot of opportunity on retreat to talk shop with one another?
Well, we're trying not to talk shop because it's for fraternity and for prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But it gets into the conversation. What can I say?
Well, yeah, you'll say a young priest, somebody who has just been ordained or recently ordained, they will come to one of the older guys and say, I've run into this. How do I handle it? Do you see that?
Yeah, that sometimes happens. But also, many of the priests belong to support groups, and they have good friendships. So that dialogue goes on all year long. But it gets enhanced on the retreat.
Well, you've mentioned that you have speakers. Now, this is a bonus that are invited to talk. Some are very good, you said. Who are one or two that have stood out in your mind over the years? Or maybe the subjects that have stood out in your mind over the years?
Well, I think the retreat directors that most impressed me were the ones that understood the kind of life that we lead and had things to say that really helped us, that hit home. You know, in religion, being a preacher myself, sometimes we can just use a lot of religious language, but we don't really know what we're talking about. But if a good retreat director will give his words clearly and to the heart, and that's what we appreciate the most.
And they can speak from an insider's point of view as well, which I'm sure is valuable.
Well, I think probably anybody could give a priest retreat if they spoke from their heart about what their experience of God is, and also the experience of doubt and worry and the like.
Well, how does the atmosphere, or does it, enhance the experience? You're out there in the desert, and this particular resort, for those of you who have not been there, I'd suggest you go. It's wonderful because there are a lot of the individual casitas out there where individual guys can have their own quarters and be alone to think, to read, to do whatever they want. It's really quite a unique atmosphere, isn't it?
It's a very beautiful place. It's been there since the 20s. The trees are all grown. They keep the grounds beautifully. I don't know how they do it now in the drought, but they do. And it's a place where you just kind of wind down, which is an important part of a retreat.
Yeah. Frank Capra, the screenwriter, almost lived out there. He set up shop. He said that was where he went to write his screenplay. So that gives you an idea right there.
That's right.
You said that one of your favorite parts of the retreat is the music at the liturgies. All you guys get a chance to do a lot of singing. Tell us about that.
Well, we have a wonderful fellow who comes out to lead it, and he chooses beautiful songs. We do some old-time chants. We do some modern songs. We do psalms. And I think, you know, it highlights the prayerful atmosphere. Knowing that everybody is doing it together gives you a sense of solidarity in your prayer, and it enhances it. Most of us say our office every day by ourselves, so it's great to be praying together.
And I noticed in one of the photographs that Father John Moneypenny provided, you're down at St. Francis of Assisi Church part of it, yeah.
We have a Jubilee Mass where those are celebrating their 50th and their 25th. Ordination anniversaries are honored and prayed for. And so the last couple of years, we've gone down to St. Francis of Assisi to have that special Mass.
And I wanted to get to that now. You celebrate the sacraments together, and you've mentioned that you celebrate the sacrament of the sick with some of the priests, and you have penance services as well. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I think the word is probably out that priests are sinners just like everybody else.
No.
Yep. Yep. You know, the benefit of the penance service is you have a sense that we're all sinners, and you take strength from that. So when we come to the time for the confession part, there are particular priests set aside to hear confessions, but most of the guys just have a regular friend or buddy or spiritual director who they go to, and
mm-hmm.
So you just go to one of the rooms and go to confession.
What about the sacrament of the sick?
Well, we've added this, I don't know how many years ago, a few years ago. It's, to me, one of the most touching parts of the retreat. There was probably a dozen people who wanted to be anointed. And so, you know, the bishop led the ceremony, and then at one point, we all laid hands on them individually. It took a while, but it's, you know, it's a way of showing our care. We don't see each other that often.
Mm-hmm.
And just the touch of someone who is in need of anointing, who feels that he's sick, sick enough to receive the sacrament, it's a wonderful thing to be able to support that guy.
That is wonderful. It's also an opportunity to celebrate the older priests and meet and get to know the newer ones, correct?
Yes. We have social time every evening, and we eat together, and people go to different tables so that they could get to know the older guys if you're younger and get to know the younger guys if you're older. And I think that's one of the secrets to our success as a presbyterate. We like to get together, and we have a lot of respect for each other.
Well, and you've also said that at the end of it all, you said that everybody is eager to get back to your parishes. Before you go, you're saying, oh, boy, I can't wait to get out to La Quinta and relax and be with the guys. But at the end of it all, you want to come right back and get to work again. That's true?
Well, usually this time of year, there's a lot of things going on in the parish, like graduations and the like.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always something waiting for you. And we work weekends, so when you leave on Friday, you got to get ready for the weekend for weddings and funerals and the masses and have your homily going.
Right. But but you do come back feeling energized and ready to go again.
I do. I like being with the guys. They like to listen to the speaker. And, you know, sometimes the speakers are great, sometimes they're not. It doesn't really influence our retreat because it's being together that is the most important part.
Well, Monsignor Mike here, many thanks for stopping by to be with us today and for giving us more insight into the lives of our priests. Please come back and join us again soon.
I'd be happy to.
And that's it for another edition of Orange County Catholic Radio. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. for another hour of good talk and intriguing topics. You're tuned to Immaculate Heart Radio, AM 1000. I'm Patrick Mott.